Good afternoon. You're listening to Gambling with an Edge. Now here are your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Scotty Shetler, former bookmaker who ran the Stardust Sportsbook in the period of time right after the Mafia was forced out. We'll be discussing his book, We Were Wise Guys and Didn't Know It. Scotty Shetler, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here, now, guys.
How did you get started in the bookmaking business, and when was this?
Well, when I was a teenager, I was actually booking bets, you know, small, real small, you know, maybe $50 would be a big bet in Western Pennsylvania, which wasn't unusual back there because everybody gambled, was a bookmaker or whatever. And from there, I I fought the law, and the law won. So I was gone for a couple years. And when I was in Sunday school there, I was booking in there, and I got out. Yeah, it's true.
What would they bet? Cigarettes or what?
Yeah, exactly. Cigarettes and soap. Yeah. So, anyways, I got out and come home, got a job in a barber shop. I learned to trade while I was in there. I got a job in a barber shop and was taking small bets there, parlay cards. The guys would leave the parlay cards in the mailbox, and I would get out and get them. And I was well-schooled in bookmaking. I mean, I was good at it. And I says, what the heck? This is like in the 60s, like this period of time, like 1967. I says, I'm going to go to Las Vegas and be a big deal. So anyways, I went to Las Vegas, and I wasn't a big deal. I lasted about a week, and I come back home to Pennsylvania, saved up some money, and went back to Las Vegas. And from there, it's like a Horatio Alger story. Everything just fell into place. And I had a lot of people helping me in Las Vegas. And the rest is history, you know. So I got a
Churchill
job.
Churchill Downs.
Churchill
Downs Race and Sports Book. Was that the first one you were at in Vegas?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And so tell us some of the things that went on there.
Oh, boy. That was, as far as I'm concerned, that's probably the greatest book that ever was, along with the Stardust, of course. And it was two rooms. It was two rooms right next to the Aladdin Hotel, which is bulldozed now. And one side was the races and the other side was sports. And Bob Martin had the sports, and I would be hanging around there and everything. And I got to be good friends with another kid from Pennsylvania, Ray Lindsay, who was a writer. And Bob left, and a guy named Frank Hall came in. He's from Texas, and he was a bookmaker from Texas. And Ray got me a job there. This would be 72. I started working there, and it was just an amazing place. Nobody in those days, there was no computers. Everything was done by hand. So you had to know what you're doing. You couldn't just walk in and get a job. You had to know how to odds, how to figure parlays, how to write tickets. You had to know when people were trying to scam you. You had to know when the game started. I mean, everything was up to you. There was no computer to get you out of the jam. So I'm writing tickets by hand, and we're paying by hand, paying live tickets. You know, a guy comes up to the cashier, gives him a live ticket. There's no computer to figure it out. You got to figure it out right there. You know, some guy has a 16 fight all around Robin. You got to figure it out, you know. And at the end of the day, we counted our drawers down. And but Churchill was strictly bookmaking. There was no tourists come in there to look around and say, you know, like today, they go in and they say, oh, my God, look at this place. That wasn't Churchill Downs. Churchill Downs had one TV, a 27-inch TV mounted on the ceiling, on the wall, and that was it. There was no entertainment. There was nothing. We had a reader board with the scores come in an old Western Union machine. Man, that thing banged away, and a ticker tape come out and got scores on there. And anybody in there wanted to bet. There was no just walking in loafing. You wanted to bet, or else you were trying to scam some money off of somebody. It was like a Damon Runyon place.
You mentioned you had to know when the game started, and there was no – you had one TV. I mean, or did you just say the game's scheduled to go off at 3, so we'll close the betting at 3? Or how did you know when game started?
Well, we all had a schedule. At that time, it was the JK schedule. It was in a book form, and it was like a Bible. Everybody had one. Everybody had one, a better, you know. And they had the list of the games, the game number that you wrote on the ticket, and the time the game started. And, of course, the home team's on the bottom, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so you had to keep it. That was our computer. So when the game started, you scratch that game off your schedule, and you just had to know. You could, you know, if somebody tried to pass post you, you know, like nowadays, the computer won't take the bet. But we had to know that the game started. I mean, it was no place for dummies. We had to know what we're doing. And me coming from a bookmaking background, they just plugged me in and I was ready to go from day one. You know, there's no on-the-job training, you know. So, and there was a lot of scams, man. People just tried everything possible to scam you. You know, for anywhere from $5 to $20 to $5,000. You know, there's just
how would they try to do that?
Well, at that time, there was a 10% tax, a federal gambling tax. I can say this now because everybody's dead, so nobody can get in trouble. So, anyways, obviously, if you pay 10% on top of your bet, that's 10% of the bet. You bet $100, you have to give the government $10. So your bet's $110. So that's not the 11 to 10 vagaries. It's just, that would be $120 you would have to give them. So obviously the bookmaker and the gambler couldn't get along like that. So we figured out a way that we could beat the income tax. So at the bottom of the ticket, before you released it, you put a little R on the bottom of the ticket. That, in case an agent asks you what that means refund. So I'm going to refund the guy's tax, which of course we didn't. So anyways, if a guy bets $500, we would write the bet as $50. Okay. And we would pay the tax on the 50, but not the 500. So one particular guy, Brian, he was a stone degenerate. He came in and we had to know we called him the R customers. So Brian comes in and he says, give me 5,000 on, I forget who it was, Denver, 5,000 on Denver. And I says, okay, Brian. So I wrote him a ticket for 500. So he would only have to pay tax on the 500. And he says, oh no, make it out for 5,000. I says, Brian, you're crazy. I says, why do you want to pay the extra tax? He says, oh no, that's okay. Make it out for 5,000. So I did. I made it out for 5,000 with no R in the bottom. So it was just a $5,000 ticket. So Brian is hoping that the ticket loses so that he can pocket the 5,000. He told the guys back in Denver that it only cost him, you know, 10%, you know, they didn't know about the 10%. So here the ticket won. So these guys from Denver, and they weren't nice guys, these guys from Denver come in to collect their money. And the cashier says, well, that ticket's only worth $500. And they say, oh no, it's worth $5,000. No, that ticket's $5,000. Brian wrote that. So anyways, Brian's in big trouble. So he already got rid of the 5,000. He blew it. So he has to leave town, which he did. And I don't know what happened to him, but that's just one of the scams, you know.
You, when you first got to town, you worked at Tower of Pizza. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That's the greatest Italian restaurant in the history of the world.
Man, I love that place. And it, I, like, I worked 7 to 3 in the morning when I got there in 77. And
okay,
that was one of those places you could go at 3 o'clock in the morning and it would still be jammed full of people.
Yeah, when the shows got out, all the maitre d's and the dealers and all the showgirls and entertainers and everybody went there. I mean, it was open until 3-4 in the morning, you know. So anyways, how I got the job is incredible. When I was in town, I had a room for $18. It was a real flop house. That's a week, $18 a week. So I'm looking for a job. I don't have a job and I don't know one soul in Las Vegas, not a human being. So I had one name, Little Nicky. So I went and looked up Little Nicky. He was in a taxi cab company, which at those times were mob owned. And he says, well, you want a job? He says, go up to the Tower of Peace and see Jasper and tell him I sent you. So I had to walk the whole way. I had no money for a cab. I walked up there in July and the tower wasn't open at that. It was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't open yet. And I walked in. And there's Jasper behind the counter with his granny glasses. And I said, I'm looking for Jasper. And he looks over his granny glasses. He says, I'm Jasper. Can I help you? And I says, yeah, Little Nicky sent me. He says, you might have a job for me. And he says, you want to work? And I says, yeah. He says, go back in the back. We're the only two people in there. He says, go in the back. Get a white jacket and go to work. And I says, well, what do I do? He says, I don't care. Just do something. Yeah, that's the way I started. So I was there for like a year and a half with Jasper. And he was, of course, a bookmaker. He booked. He was from New York. He was connected from New York. And the NYPD exiled him to Las Vegas. Anyways, so I learned a lot from Jasper. He'd be at the register cashing out tourists, you know, customers, and taking bets on the phone. It's the only place you could make a bet and get a pepperoni pizza at the same time. You know, you could, he had delivery. You could call up and say, give me a parlay on Alabama and Oklahoma and send a pizza over.
Yeah, I remember, I used to play backgammon with a guy who was a bookmaker there. His name was Vartan. I forget his last name, but I was young and stupid. I didn't know how the world worked. But I remember saying to him, like, Vartan, why would people go to you as a bookie when they can just go to the casino?
Yeah.
And of course he said, you know, the casino won't take your bet over the phone and they won't give you credit. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. Credit. That's a big, where did you work?
I worked at the Castaways when Sonny Reisner was there with the hole in the wall.
Did you work in the book?
No. I was a blackjack dealer.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sonny. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So that's, I was with Jasper for like about a year and a half. He went to the can eventually, but
for bookmaking or he getting
No. He was a stand-up guy. He the grand jury, federal grand jury, met and they subpoenaed him to be a witness. And of course he wouldn't divulge anything. So the grand jury, they have the feds have the ability to send you back to prison for 6 months, let you out again. Bring you back to court. If you talk, you can leave. If you don't, you go back for another 6 months. That went on for 5 years. He did 5 years by keeping his mouth shut. And that's why I went to the camp too. I kept my mouth shut, but that's beside the point. But anyways, he got out. He was a sick guy when he got out. And believe it or not, like in a movie, he opened a flower shop. And yeah, it's true. He opened a flower shop and he was the gardener for Our Lady of Las Vegas Catholic Church. And that's that. And he eventually died, you know. So.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I was sorry to see that restaurant close.
Yeah. You could go back in the kitchen and tell them you could make your own food. I mean, it was so loose and people would go behind the bar and pour their own drinks. It was just incredible. And the tips, oh my God, the tips, it was all waitresses. They had to go home with bags with the tips in it, you know. I remember one time I was in the back and the guy Ernie, he was a maitre d'. He came scrolling through the back and I was doing something in the back. I was like a busboy, you know. And he says, how long's it been since you had a tip? And I says, well, we don't get tips in the back here, just out front. He gives me a Cecil, $100 bill. You know, that's just the way it was. Those days are gone.
Yeah.
They're gone, never to return. It's a shame. That's kind of why I wrote that book, to keep some of those guys alive. Some of the guys that don't get, you know, there's a lot of phonies in Las Vegas that get a lot of ink, but the guys I wrote about don't get any ink except, you know, that's why I wrote that book. Anyways, go ahead.
So you went to Churchill Downs, and after that you went to the Royal, which was a surprisingly big sports book and a surprisingly little casino.
It was a little casino. They had like one crap table, maybe a couple blackjack tables, and of course a few slot machines. And Joe Sliman from Cleveland called me up one day when I was at Churchill, and he asked me if I wanted to come down and open a book for him. And I said, well, sure, Joe, I could do that. So I never ran a book before, a legal book. So I went down, I quit Churchill, went down and started working for Joe. And Joe took the biggest action you could ever possibly imagine. Even for those days, it was big action. And so we had a little counter. It was a showroom, burlesque show. So we built a counter in there, a sports counter with like two windows. So in the daytime, there was a board behind there, handwritten. In the daytime, we lift the curtain up, turn the chairs around, and it was a sports book. So the burlesque show was on the other side of the room, the stage. At nighttime, when the books closed, the curtain come down, turn the chairs around to face the stage, and it's a burlesque show. So anyways, all that took place in one room. So Joe just took huge action. The first day I was there, some guy came in. He wanted $60,000 on the Reds. I'll never forget. He wanted $60,000 on the Cincinnati Reds. And I said, well, wait a minute. I gotta get this okayed. Because I'm used to booking both sides of, you know, for action, you know, trying to even the book out. And I says, Joe, a guy wants $60,000 on Cincinnati. What should I move it to? He says, just take it. And I says, what? He says, just take it. I says, one number? He says, yeah, just don't move it. Just take it. And he says, take everything. He says, don't turn nothing down. So anyway, can you imagine that? So.
Yeah, I mean, $60,000 in 1970s dollars. It's amazing.
Without moving the number. I mean, all in one number without moving them. Like Sonny Reisner would, he'd probably have a heart attack. we called that the chicken joint. The castaways, it was known as the chicken joint. Sonny was so conservative. I mean, he wouldn't take $100 without calling somebody to see if they get something wrong with the game. Anyways.
So. You know, I spent a lot of time in that room because sometimes it was a burlesque show, but also I had a good friend who was singing in that lounge. So I was there an awful lot.
In the Royal?
At the Royal, yeah.
Whoa, okay.
His name was Jerry Tiffy.
Jerry Tiffy. Yeah, the name's very familiar. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. He was in that room. Well, he was from Cleveland originally, and he was there. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time in that room.
Yeah.
So how long, when, until what year were you at the Royal?
I was at the Royal probably till, I was there maybe a year and a half, 2 years, probably till 79 or 80, around that time frame.
Because what I wanted to ask you about when you were talking about not moving the number, it was around that time that the computer group started.
Yeah.
And you know, they started just massacring bookmakers. And I'm wondering, like, how you handled, like, did you recognize what was happening? Did you identify who the sharp guys were, and how did you deal with that?
At the Royal, no, we just took bets. You know, if you wanted to bet, you walk up and give us your money and we'll write you a ticket. You know, no, the I don't remember the computer group until I went to the Stardust, and that's another story. But I wasn't aware of the computer group when I was at the Royal. No. So that evidently they didn't put a dent in us, you know. So.
All right. So let's talk about the Stardust.
Yeah.
You moved over there right after Lefty Rosenthal was forced out. What kind of conditions did the mob leave for you to take over?
Well, Lefty was forced out before I got there. So a guy named Ray Lindsay, who I mentioned at Churchill, he took over for Lefty, and they called him the director of race and sports, whatever that means. And anyways, I took over for Ray. It was in December of 83. And the mob was gone, supposedly. The mob was gone, and the gaming board named the Boyd Group, who had a couple local joints, cowboy joints, out on Boulder Highway. And they had no business being in there. But anyways, the Boyd, they were safe as far as the gaming board is concerned. The gaming board gave them the okay to take over the Stardust. So they had no clue. That book, the guy that they hired to run the book, he went in the back and shut the door. He didn't know what the hell to do. He wasn't used to stuff like that. So there was a guy named Warren Nelson. He's my most favorite person in the world, Warren Nelson from Reno. He had one point in there are a couple points in the Boyd Group. So he calls me up, and he calls me up. At this time, I was at Jerry's Nugget in North Las Vegas. He calls me up and asks me if I wanted to take over the Stardust. I said, sure, because the Boyd Group didn't have anybody that could handle it. They just didn't, you know. So I took over because, one thing, I knew everybody there because I had worked there before. I wrote tickets there. We're getting ahead of ourselves here. I was a ticket writer there before I took over the book. So I knew everybody. I didn't have to be introduced, or I knew what was going on. So I took over, and here, the very first week, all the old writers, before they left, they all wrote themselves tickets. It was like one big giant teaser. In other words, Southern Cal +3. And UCLA +3 playing each other. You know what I mean? And I looked at these tickets and I says, oh my God, we're going to get murdered. I says, it's impossible to win. So I went up and told the general manager, Perry Witt. I says, Perry, you know, we're in big trouble here. He says, well, we just have to weather it, you know. So the first week we lose like 300. Next week we lose another 300, paying off all these tickets. And I had to fire a couple guys, and they knew, they didn't care. They were, there's no hard feelings. They knew what they did. So I evidently got the place on where it was booking, you know, everything was on the up and up. The Boyd Group got first count. I made sure they got first count. So I'll never forget this. The year before I got there, the book took in $72 million. So the first year I was there, I took in like $140 million. And the Boyd Group says, boy, this guy's a genius. Boy, look what he did. He brought in an extra $70 million. I said, and I just laughed to myself. I'm thinking, I just counted all the money. You know what I mean? Nothing went south. I give them first count. But they thought I was a genius, you know. So anyways, my friend Warren told me he had complete, utter confidence in me. I worked for him in Reno, by the way. I opened a book for him in Reno, and I ran a good book for him in Reno. So anyways, he says, just do what you want. Don't listen to anybody. Don't listen to the bean counters. Don't listen to the pit bosses. Just do what you want, because he knew what I was capable of. He says, do what you want and don't listen to anybody. So I did. So I had a whole bunch of different ideas. Some of them I got from Bob Martin, and just some of them I brought from Pennsylvania. I had all these different ideas. So I just did what I wanted. I booked the old-fashioned way, and the rest is history. I won $47 million at the Stardust, $47 million in the 8 years I was there. So that's that.
When did Roxy Roxborough come and get involved with the Stardust, and what did he do?
Roxy, he was probably my first hire. Roxy was making odds. I knew him from Churchill. He was in Churchill when I was writing tickets. And at that time, he was a hippie, wearing sandals, long red hair, blah, blah, blah. He was just a scuffler. But he was making odds and betting. And he had, at that time, he cleaned himself up. He had a nice suit and tie and all that and respectable, but he had no customers in Las Vegas. He had four or five joints in Reno where he was making odds for, but nothing in Las Vegas. So I called Roxy, and it was around Christmas time in 83, and asked him if he wanted to come work for me, you know, making odds, helping me. He said, sure. You know, he got the Stardust. He's, you know, now he's making odds for the Stardust. So he could say, you know what I mean? So I hired Roxy, and he sent me his odds, which I am blended into other odds, you know, I had other guys too that helped me. It's, you know, so it was around Christmas 83, and Roxy said that's the best day of his life, the day that I hired him, because from there he just took off. You know, then he got everybody, you know, all the joints, you know.
Yeah.
So Roxy and I are still buddies to this day. Yeah.
Yeah, that was apparent at Bet Bash when you guys were on the same panel. And it was very clear, the rapport between the two of you.
Yep.
You mentioned that was when you first became aware of the computer group, was when you were at the Stardust. So what happened there? Tell me how that all went down.
Well, first of all, at the Stardust, we strictly booked. I mean, I booked the right way. I had my limits set where we could get two-way action. In other words, nobody could walk in and just say, give me $100,000 on Joe Blow, because I couldn't get $100,000 on the other side. I had my limits set where we could get two-way action, okay? We took $10,000 on the pros, NFL, $5,000 on the NBA, $3,000 on the colleges, basketball. And so we had so much business because we put the line up first, the first in the country in that time. We put our line up at 8 o'clock in the morning every day, just like a bank. No matter what happened the day before, win, lose, or draw, we were open at 8 o'clock in the morning with numbers that nobody has ever seen. These are all virgin numbers that we made in the back room. So now all these wise guys out front, you know, handicappers, you know, all they're just chomping at the bit to get these numbers that, you know, these rookies made, you know what I mean? But we weren't rookies. We knew what we were doing. I had four or five guys helping me. So we had so much business that we had to figure out a way to handle it. Guys were fighting over being first in line, and it's just a brutal. They went so far as to hire old drunks to stand in front of the window a day ahead of time so that they could come in and change places with them and be first in line. So I'm tired of looking at these stew bums, and I say, you know, they would stay there all night. And if somebody had to go to the bathroom, they'd all get in line and go to the bathroom like ducks. You know? So nobody could keep their same places in line. Then they'd come back like a row of ducks and get back in front of the windows. And then we decided to put stanchions up like a showroom. Well, they just ripped them apart, you know that. So anyways, my friend, a good friend of mine that worked for me, Richard Saber, he came up with the idea of having a lottery. You come in the morning, we have a sign-up sheet that's numbered from 1 to 50, say, and you put your name there. It doesn't matter what order, because we're going to have a drawing to see who goes first. So we had like four windows open. And so you draw the, the deck of cards, first card, jack of clubs. That's on the thing. That's Scotty. One-eyed Scotty, you're number one on window one. Turn another card over. Spinner Brown, you're number one on window two. So that's the way we did it. So now all these guys are lined up, including the computer group. They're all lined up. And the government should run like this. There was no talk, and you couldn't talk because somebody could say, hey, to the guy in front, hey, bet this for me. You know what I mean? No talking and no passing notes. And if you're in line, you had to bet. You had to make at least a $300 bet. So these guys are, some of them have $100,000 in their pocket and they're saying, hey, he's talking. No, it's Damon Wright. Hollywood couldn't produce this. All these guys, Hollywood would love this. So he's talking, he's passing the note. So then I'd have to 86 him for a couple of days. You know what I mean? Richard talked about getting 86 guys, but he said they went up to the office and asked if they could get back in. Can you remember that at the Bet Bash?
Yeah.
And anyways, so now.
You said there were guys who would be crying if you 86'd them.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of guys they were service guys. Our line went all over the country. You know, all these bookmakers all over the country, newspapers, bookmakers, everybody. The line came from the Stardust. So if I 86 somebody, they can't come in. They're out of business. They got to get the line from somebody else. You know what I mean? And by that time, it's too late. Anyways, so the computer group. Are we talking about the computer? Are we talking about?
Billy I was Wallace? Asking how you became aware of them and what you did deal with it.
I'm good. So Billy Walters, smartest gambler around. Without a doubt, the best gambler around sports, without a doubt. So he would have guys, he would have one or two of his guys come in the morning and make bets that he wanted to lose, because he knew that once we put our line up, started taking bets, the line was massaged, and by 9 o'clock it was solid, okay? It was painted. So now all the other books in town, Sonny Riser and all these other books, would come in and copy our line and figured, oh, this is a solid line now. And they put it up. So Billy helped move those numbers to where he wanted to bet the other side. So he could go all over town, 20 other books, and just cherry pick, bet opposite of what he bet us. Okay. Hoping that we win, because that means he's going to win. So anyways, nobody ever, I mean, it was like we'd win and other books would lose. And they say, ah, that's Stardust. They're lucky. No, we're not lucky. We just know what the hell we're doing. You know, so anyways, yeah, he set up the whole town. So
your policy was anybody could bet. And so if I came in and I said, you know, I want 10,000 on this game, you would take it, move the line, and then I could bet another 10 and move the line again. Yeah. And bet I could keep betting as much as I wanted, right?
Sure. Yeah. That's what we're open for. Yeah. You can bet on. Yeah.
So it was a different time.
Yep. Well, we were a different book. A lot of books back then would, you know, if you wanted to bet 10,000, they might call the SWAT team. They might think that, you know, you're half smart, you know. We knew that the player was our friend. Without the player, we don't have a job. And without us, the players, though, can't bet. So it was a mutual understanding. There was no we didn't care if we didn't look at each ticket like, geez, if we wrote a ticket and it won, it's not like, you know, we lost that ticket. It's just part of the overall, you know, the overall mix. We didn't care. If we got middled, so what? Big deal. The guy's not going to leave and go somewhere else and say, I got your money and I'm never giving it back to you. I'm leaving. I'm going home. Never happened. You know what I mean? They never left the Stardust because we changed numbers so quick. We might change 700-800 numbers a day. They never left because they're afraid to miss a number. So, and one of the first things I did was put safe deposit boxes in there, like a bank. So in the cage, we had a whole wall of safety deposit boxes. So when these guys left at night, they left their money there.
I had one of those boxes.
Did you?
I did. So yeah.
The money never left the building. So yeah. They come in the morning, get their money back, and give it right back to us. It's so easy to book, You know what I mean? And it was, those boxes are full of winning tickets and chips. And I don't know how much was in yours, but,
Yeah, well, it was pretty sizable. I mean, the other thing was the phones. People don't realize today, like now people can use their cell phones in a sports book. Back then, not only didn't you have a cell phone, you couldn't put a phone near the sports book, right? I mean.
No, you could not. First of all, you couldn't have a cell phone in the book, a player. You know, it was against the regulations. There was actually a regulation. You can't have phones in the book. And you can't have a phone visible to the odds board. So in other words, even in the pit couldn't, their phones in the pit couldn't be visible to the odds boards. That's how strict they were. So I said, well, what the hell? I figured out a way to get around that. So I looked across the book, and there's a room over there where the porters kept their mops and brooms and all that kind of stuff. So I went upstairs and asked them, can I have this room? I'm going to put some phones in there. So I put phones. Warren said I could do whatever I want. Don't listen to anybody. So I put phones. I had a bank of phones on the wall facing the book, but you couldn't see the book. You know, there's no way you could see the book. They're just phones. And they would only take, you could only have 702 numbers. That's the only number that would either, you couldn't call in, but you could call out, okay?
These were not pay phones. These were just house phones.
No, these are house phones. Yeah, but you could call out. You could call another book if they answer the phone, or you could call your bookmaker. You call anybody you want, as long as it's a 702 number within the state of Nevada. So here we are. Other people are throwing people out because they're sneaking a cell phone outside. And we're saying, well, come over here, bring your money over here. We'll take it. So now we've got guys that never leave the book. They just they bet with us, call their bookmaker, maybe bet the other side, or else they call their, we have a different number. They call their bookmaker, then bet the other side with us. It was beautiful. And the gaming board they were just beside themselves because we weren't breaking in laws. You know what I mean? And we had a guy named, we called it Abner's room, little Abner. Remember Abner?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So he was like the janitor. He took all the graffiti off the walls and phone numbers and kept it neat and swept it up. And if a tourist happened to stumble in there, he'd throw them out because we need the phones. Oh, it was a riot.
Well, you had cell phones just outside.
Before you ask that question, Richard, before you ask your question, we need to take a break for commercials. We still have plenty of questions left for Scotty Shetler, so we'll be right back.
All right.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning at least 99%. This is more such games than anyone else has. In May, the promotion is half price gas and goods. For every $8,334 of coin-ins, slots, or video poker you earn and redeem in May, normally worth $25 in cash, free play, or you can spend it at various hotel and casino outlets, you'll get a $50 Walmart or Chevron gift cards. You may earn up to 10 of these in May in any combination. Note that you do not keep your points. When you redeem for each $50 gift card, you are giving up $25 worth of points. Still, assuming you value the gift cards the same as cash, it's effectively a 0.6% slot club for the first $83,000 coin-in you play in May. On Sunday, May 8th, Mother's Day, earn 300 points between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m., and you can pick up a free tin of See's candy, which goes for $27 retail. On this promotion, you keep your points and these points count towards earning Chevron and Walmart cards. On Monday, May 30th, 8 a.m. to midnight, there's a $32,000 hot seat promotion where every 3 minutes, one lucky player receives $100 in free play. If you haven't finished earning your 10 gift cards by then, playing on this day is a form of double dipping.
Hey, this is Colin from Blackjack Apprenticeship, and if you're serious about card counting, I'm sure Bob and Richard would agree that there are three things every Advantage player needs to succeed. You need to gain the edge over the house, you need to manage your bankroll, and you need to get the hours in at the casinos. After a decade of playing professionally and running teams, I wanted to create the exact training, tools, and community I wished I had had for myself and my Blackjack teams, so we created the Blackjack Apprenticeship membership. Our membership will help you perfect your game, manage your bankroll, and you'll join a supportive community of like-minded card counters and APs. Find out more at blackjackapprenticeship.com.
VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Triple Triple Bonus Poker. This is an ultra-high variance game. It is similar to Triple Double Bonus in that you get paid $800 for one for all aces with a 2, 3, or 4 kicker, but this time you also get $800 for one for all 2s, 3s, and 4 with an ace kicker. This is an additional $400 for one over Triple Double Bonus, and it occurs approximately every 13,000 hands. To pay for this, straights are reduced from paying 4 to 1 to 3 to 1. Which costs you a bit more than 1% because straights come about approximately 1 in 97 hands in this game. The variance is around 140, which will make you wish you stayed home if you don't hit one of the big hands today. All right, we're back talking with Scotty Shuttler. Richard, if you remember your question, you can ask it. If you don't remember what you were going to ask, I have one.
Well, we were talking about the phones, and I wanted to say you had pay phones kind of out the door around the corner, right? And those.
Yeah. Outside, there was a bank of phones, and I think there were 7 or 8 of them outside, and pay phones. And the telephone company told us they're the busiest bank of phones in the country. I mean, they were constantly, you couldn't even get near them. So in the morning, when our line went up, it was a mad rush for those phones because these guys had to call New Jersey, New York, California, wherever, and get their line out. You know what I mean? So I remember one day there was a – you remember Bobby the Midget?
I worked with him. Bobby the Bullet?
He's a midget.
Yeah. He was a world champion midget wrestler. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he – worked at the Castaways as a blackjack dealer until he got fired for coming to work drunk. And he fell off his box. He would stand on a little box to deal blackjack. Yeah. And he got so drunk, he fell off it, and they fired him. So
okay. Anyways, if we're talking about the same Bobby the Midget, he was a bookmaker, the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So one day he's outside, and the line changed. And he had to get to the phone real quick to make a bet or change his book, whatever he's doing. Anyways, he couldn't reach the slot to put his quarter in. So he's trying to slam dunk it. He's jumping up, trying to slam dunk his quarter into the slot. Oh, my God. Yeah. So anyways, yeah. But we also had phones in the book that you could call in and bet. In other words, behind the counter. When the gaming board okayed them.
Oh, that was later. Yeah.
Yeah. Towards the end of my reign there, the gaming board okayed phones in the book.
But they were coming from Nevada, you couldn't take it across the state line.
Yeah. It had to be a 702 number. Yeah. So anyways, we did a tremendous amount of business on the phones. I mean, they were a blessing. They helped us book. In other words, we could take whatever we want at the counter, and the phones would grab it because they're all strange numbers. You know, we'd move it at the counter. The books, the phones would never let those numbers go by. Beautiful two-way action. It was just like a money machine. So we, the more how it worked. The more we lost on the phones, the more we won at the counter. But upstairs, the board group, they couldn't understand that. You know what I mean? They looked at the phones and they said, geez, if we eliminate these phones, look at all the more money we're going to have. No, that don't work like that, you know. But anyways, yeah. So we had phones behind the counter, which, especially NFL, Sunday at kickoff time, if we're out of whack on games, the phone bets would just lap it up. You know what I mean? Because we could give them all strange numbers. If we got middle, who cares? They're not going out. They're not leaving town. So, yeah.
So on the phone bets, you had to be a known bettor.
You had to come in, register, make identification. Yeah. Money on deposit. There was no credit. But yet you had to be a legitimate resident of Nevada, verified. You know, you had to give us whatever the gaming board wanted. You know, but guys would, some guys in New York, they're in back east, they come out and they rented storage lockers, little wee lockers, you know, and those storage things. And they put answering machines in there that switched the phone relay, you know what I mean? They would call the storage shed, it would relay it to the book. So it would come out as a 702 number. Can you imagine that? And they're betting from New York, and it's going through this storage shed, and it's shooting it into the book. Anyways, that's what's on. Okay.
So you took a lot of wise guy action at the Stardust.
We wanted it. We welcomed it. We went after it. Other books were chasing them away, and we says, come over. We'll take your money. I could never figure out if a guy won a big bet at one of these books, they chase him. He's got their money. And they're kicking him out, and he's got their money. They've got no chance to get it back. So he bring it over to Stardust, give it to us. You know, like I said, we won $47 million in the 8 years I was there. Anyways.
Yeah, I mean, when I interviewed Billy Walters, he said, you know, how could you not want the information? Why would you not want to know what the wise guy is betting?
Yeah. Well, we also, we actually wouldn't move a number just because a wise guy bet. I mean, in those days, everybody handicapped. I mean, it's not like today where they just sign up for a service. Back then, everybody handicapped, and there was different opinions, and guys would bet both sides. Billy might bet one side, and some of the other guys say, hey, he's wrong. We'll bet the other side. So we actually didn't shiver when wise guys walked in because we had so damn many of them. You know, we just took their bets, you know.
Actually, you know, to that point, before when you were working at the Stardust, before you took it over, when you were a ticket writer – wrote tickets for other kinds of wise guys who could come in and sort of demand their own numbers?
Yeah. Well, you know, Lefty was running the book, and that speaks for itself. And it was owned by some very nice people in Chicago. And that's, you could come in and say, you know, I'm so-and-so, you know, give me a Southern Cal minus +3 and they're -3. You know what I mean?
Give him that ticket. So it was just a way for them to, another way to skim.
There was no bookmaking. Yeah, right. The more money they took in, the more they could steal. So it was just, you know, it was just, there was no booking involved in it. It was just bring it in, you know, like you said, the more money they could steal. You know.
Yeah. Did you ever deal with Spilotro?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I knew Tony. Yeah, we were, in fact, at Churchill. That's where I met Tony. Tony would, each writer had a phone on the counter. We didn't take bets on it. We just give out scores and stuff like that. You know what I mean? There's no bets on the phone. But Tony would call up And he would only talk to me because I had the ticker behind me. So Tony would get me on the phone and he'd just be bullshitting with me to keep me there because he wanted scores. So he could hear the ticker, but ticking, you know, it made a big racket. He says, "Oh, what's that score?" And I give him the score. And, you know, you don't tell Tony Spilotro, you know, "Forget it, Tony, I'm hanging up now." You don't tell him. So anyways, when I went to the Stardust, he had guys that would come in and bet. And it was just, they had so much money, you know, well, give me Notre Dame plus 10,000. I mean, give me Notre Dame for 10,000. Geez, Eddie, we're loaded on that game. We really don't want anymore. He says, "Well, give me the other side then." You know, that's just the way it was, you know. And then he says, "Well, then you tell me who to bet." You know what I mean? So they had so much money that, you know, yeah.
Wanted to be in action.
Yeah, they wanted the action. Exactly. That's that. They wanted the sweat games. Yeah, exactly. "Well, you tell me who to bet then."
Yeah, you got to love a customer like that.
Yeah, we had them. We welcomed them. Why? They called them wise guys. They were wise guys. You know, we welcomed them. You know, if one of those guys walked in another book, they'd liable to close the hotel down. You know.
Well, I why did you choose that title for your book? We were wise guys and didn't know it.
We weren't big deals at that time. We were just at that time. We were just. We could have just as easy went on the other side of the counter and fit right in. You know, we were one of the guys. You know, we were, now we would be wise guys. But back then we were just, excuse me, we were no better than them, no worse than them, the players, you know. So they're wise guys, we're wise guys. I mean, what's a wise guy anyways, you know. But anyways, we didn't realize it. Nowadays we'd be a wise guy. But back then, we were just, you know, doing our jobs, you know. So that's where we weren't anything special, you know, to us, you know.
When did your reign at the Stardust end and why?
In 91. It ended in 91, like November, December 91. The Boyd Group was sick of me because all the wise guys action. In other words, the Boyd Group was the cowboy joint. They were cowboy people. They had Sam's Town and all these cowboy joints out in the Boulder Highway and Henderson. And they just weren't used to all this. And the gaming board wasn't happy with me, you know, because all the wise guys, you know, all the wise guys we were doing, they just couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. Nothing was going on. We were writing tickets and paying taxes. Anyways, the gaming board wasn't happy with me because our line was going around all over the country. I was being subpoenaed by, you know, the feds we found your schedule on a bookmaker in Denver. Are you giving him the line? No, it's a schedule. You know, he's got a schedule in his pocket. I didn't give him the line, you know. Anyways, They were finally sick of me, the Boyd Group. They wanted to get rid of me and get rid of the wise guys. So we came to a mutual agreement. What really did it was, like I said about the phones, they brought in this guy that got rid of all the phone cut, the new general manager. I lasted through six general managers, by the way. They brought in a new one, and he 86'd all the winning customers on the phones. In other words, we had a huge phone list. He went through, and guys that were in the plus, he eliminated them, you know, got rid of them. You know what I mean? And they figured, well, gee, look at all the money we're going to make now. You know, and I wrote it on, I figured it out on pencil and paper and showed them how the phones make us money. But they couldn't get it. It went right over their head. And so I just said, "Hell with this. Let me get out." They had a big investigation. They say, "Well, what's Scotty up to? He must be up to something, you know, because all these wise guys are coming in." And here they had an investigation. I had like 80 employees. They interviewed every one of them, every employee they interviewed trying to find something on me. Nothing. Zero. Zilch. The only thing they come up with was, I'm a nice boss. I'm a good boss. So finally, they says, well, we're not going to fire you. You can stay here, but you have to lower your limits. You have to do this and that. And I says, well, I'll see you later. You know, so I left.
Yeah, you know, I have a great recommendation for those guys on the, you know, baccarat and craps and blackjack tables. Just eliminate all the hands where they lose, and they'll make so much more money. Right? If we only accept the winning bets.
Yeah, there you go. Just take winners. There you go.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling how little people running these joints now understand about how gambling works.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, this whole thing was over their head. They weren't satisfied with the millions, you know. And besides, we packed the hotel rooms because of the book. We figured that we added 3% to the bottom line of the Stardust total. Restaurants, tables. I mean, people come from all over the country just to go to the Stardust book, you know. Rub elbows with the wise guys, you know. It meant nothing to them. They brought in another guy. I'm not going to mention him. He was at the Bet Bash, but all he wanted to do was take parlay cards. I mean, what the hell, you know? So anyways, they lived off the name, the Stardust Sportsbook, for a while, but then, you know, now the Stardust is gone. So, but those days will never come back. It's just, you know, what good times they were. Just good times, you know, good times. But that atmosphere will never come back. Now it's all sterile. It's like a hospital, you know. It's just, now it's a lot of the guys, like I had guys helping me make numbers, and I paid them pretty good. And, you know, we made the numbers, and nowadays it's all computer driven. You know, they got it figured out. They micromanage it because it's figured out to the tenth of a penny. You know what I mean? It's not even fun anymore. Most of these guys, they're nerds. A lot of them are just nerds, computer nerds. They figure out how to, you know, it means nothing to them, the teams. You know, back then, everybody, like in Churchill, there was nobody in there who wasn't a sports fan. You know what I mean? You didn't go there for the tips. You're to watch a cocktail waitresses because there was none. You know, it's just, you know, it's just all completely different now. I don't think I could survive nowadays. My the way I booked, I don't know if it'll work today or not. You know, I just don't know. Probably not. So, but anyways, I had my turn. So my saying is, times change. Either change with them or get out of the way, you know. Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, Scotty, this has been great, and I just want to thank you so much. This was really good.
Yeah. Okay. If somebody wants to acknowledge me, they can make a donation to Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Okay.
So that's it, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. We'll put that down as your recommended.
Right. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Terrific. Okay. Thank you, Scotty.
Thanks, Richard. Thank you very much. Thanks, Bob.
Well, thank you, Scotty Shetler. That was very informative. At the end of our show, we have a recommended section. Richard, do you have a recommended for our audience today?
Yeah, my recommended is a TED Talk by a magician named Darren Brown. And we'll put a link in the show notes. I've talked about it before that one of the areas of magic that I'm really interested in is mentalism. And Darren Brown is a mentalist, and he does a pretty amazing demonstration in his TED Talk. And, you know, if you like that, you can go down a rabbit hole. He has a number of shows on Netflix. But anyway, that is my recommended. It's pretty amazing TED Talk.
A number of shows on Netflix or on YouTube?
Well, he probably is on YouTube also, but on Netflix – I think he did a series for the BBC. So, but those shows are, well, I only watched one of them, and it is not just a performance of mentalism. He's also kind of interested in psychology and very hard to describe. The show I watched was I watched two of them. And but one of them was about could he basically take a guy – this is going to sound bizarre, but take a guy who is a bigot and make him risk his life for somebody else that that normally he is kind of prejudiced against.
Yes.
Yeah, and so it's a mixture of psychology and embedding and a lot of things. That show was kind of weird. But anyway, the TED Talk is what I want to focus on, and that's the one to watch.
Does he get into how to do it?
Yes. Yeah, he does talk about it. Yep.
All right. Sounds interesting. I will definitely watch that. My recommended is a movie called The Imitation Game. It's a 2014 movie starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley. And it's based on the true story of Alan Turing, who was leading a bunch of mathematical geniuses in deciphering Enigma, which was a machine Germany used during World War II to codify military messages. Through a series of flashbacks and forward flashes, we know early on that Turing is a homosexual and that it was illegal to be one in Britain at that time. The movie is based on a true story. I found it very absorbing.
Yeah, I thought it was a great movie.
Lots of Oscar nominations. They won one for Best Adapted Screenplay. Cumberbatch and Knightley were both nominated but did not win. It was nominated for Best Picture. It didn't win either, but it was a very good movie.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you, Scotty Shetler. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.